Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Coming up, our week in review, in which we'll be talking about the week's big story, the killing of Osama bin Laden by U.S. Special Forces, and how that prompted people from Boston and the region to remember those killed on 9/11.
But we begin today with news from the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. This afternoon, the SJC issued a major decision regarding legal immigrants and whether or not they should be allowed to participate in the state's landmark health reform plan.
The court ruled that the state's exclusion of thousands of legal immigrants from state-subsidized health coverage collides with constitutional rights. And joining us to explain is WBUR reporter Martha Biebinger. Martha Biebinger, good to have you, Martha.
Hi, Anthony.
So, Martha, who filed the suit and what do they want?
It was a group of legal immigrants, some of whom were already in Commonwealth Care, the state's subsidized health insurance plan. Some of them had serious illnesses. One gentleman who's a secretary at a United Methodist Church in Saugus found lung cancer while he was on Commonwealth Care, got cut off, and wasn't sure how to continue his treatment. They felt like they had the same right to this coverage as other legal immigrants, other legal citizens who were paying taxes and paying for this benefit as part of being citizens of the Massachusetts.
So thousands of legal immigrants, and they were cut off. This was part of a budget-cutting effort, correct?
Right. The state cut this group out of Commonwealth Care in 2009 to save $130 million. They created a cheaper product for this group that cost about $40 million, so you can imagine it was much thinner benefits.
So my understanding is this decision today by the SJC doesn't challenge the law so much. What exactly does it do?
This decision today says that this group is likely equal to the same benefits as citizens of the state of Massachusetts. This step was required to clarify what the legal protections were for this group. This stage does not throw out the law that excluded them. That would be part of a separate court procedure if the advocates choose to go there.
Okay, so this gives them legal standing. So do we assume then that the next step is they're going to challenge this law?
We assume that they're going to try to get people back into Commonwealth Care. They're going to go to the legislature and to the governor's office and see if they can make the case that the writing's on the wall and that this is going to happen eventually anyway, so why don't you just do it? If that doesn't happen, they will likely go to the courts to get a legal ruling that forces the state to restore benefits for people.
So today's hearing essentially gives them the clout of we're constitutionally recognized as, and you better do something or else.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So how's the state likely to respond? How are lawmakers likely to respond? Do we know?
There is no uniformity to date on this. The governor restored funding for this limited benefits program. The governor has been an advocate for equal benefits for this group, recognizing, though, that the state's in a tight budget squeeze right now. The legislature has been less likely to include this group in benefits. So it's not clear whether their momentum or interest will change. It is clear that this is going to cost them around $140 million at a time when we're already seeing a lot of budget cuts. So I think it's really up in the air right now, Anthony.
All right. Well, we'll follow this story closely with your help. Thanks, Martha. Thanks. Martha Biebinger, reporter for WBUR, reporting today on a major decision by the Supreme Judicial Court. And let's move on now to our week in review. And this week's huge story, of course, that has dominated national headlines. And, of course, we're talking about the killing of al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden by U.S. Special Forces. Joining us to talk about that and the other news of the week is Charlie Sennett. He's executive editor of the Boston-based Global Post. And thanks for coming in, Charlie.
Sure. Great
always,
to be here.
Always good to see you.
Thanks.
And Peter Kanellos of the Boston Globe. Peter, always good to have you.
Thank you.
Well, gentlemen, there's a lot to talk about here. Among the biggest questions is what it means for U.S. relations with Pakistan, which was very much the focus of hearings this week conducted by Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And among the big questions, how Osama bin Laden could have been hiding right under the noses of Pakistani officials without them knowing or being somehow complicit in it. Congress has appropriated some $3 billion in aid to Pakistan for this year, and some lawmakers say that aid should be cut off unless the Pakistanis can prove they weren't somehow complicit. Kerry urged caution. Let's hear a bit of what he said first.
We should not rush into a situation that, in fact, hurts our own interests. A legitimate analysis concludes that it is undeniable that our relationship with Pakistan has helped us pursue our security goals.
So, Charlie Sennett, let me start with you. Kerry seems to be saying, yeah, it might be bad, it might be complicated with the Pakistanis, but we need them, right?
Yeah, we absolutely do need them. I mean, the idea, I think, that's at play here is that I think Pakistan was probably helping the United States more than they themselves can give themselves credit. What I mean by that is there's real political liability for them inside Pakistan for appearing to be helping the United States to take out Osama bin Laden. That could really hurt the government. And that's hard for those of us in America to get our heads around. But this is a very complex ally with a very complex equation on the domestic and international front. I agree with this notion that it's impossible to imagine that next door to their equivalent to West Point, bin Laden could be living without some elements of the government knowing that he was there. Hmm. But that's different than all of the elements of the government knowing he was there, and that's different still from whether or not they can publicly say that they helped carry out this incredibly courageous and effective raid.
Hmm. Peter Kanellis, you know, there does seem to be a bit of a mood in Washington among some lawmakers that reminds me a little bit of that scene out of Casablanca. You know, there's gambling going on. I'm shocked. I mean, the idea that Pakistan hasn't always been working in consort with American interests in the region isn't exactly new.
Yeah, it isn't exactly new, and I strongly agree with what Charlie said. And the two key points are that there's a very delicate situation within Pakistan, even in the relationship between the civilian government of President Zardari and the intelligence and military forces. So some elements of the Pakistani government could sincerely be helping us, and others could be undercutting us. And it only underscores the fact that it's a complicated situation, and we shouldn't, you know, rush to punish all Pakistanis in one brush. Secondly, you know, what is the alternative? Having Pakistan as a sworn enemy is far worse than having them as a duplicitous friend. So that's all by way of saying that Senator Kerry, I think, is right and Charlie's right. And we have to proceed cautiously and do everything we can to build a good relationship there.
And in terms of what the Pakistanis do for us, I mean, love it or hate it, these drone attacks, these American drone attacks in the tribal areas continues. We just had a report today that is sort of being condoned one way or the other, supported by the Pakistani government, right? So we can't just sort of, or it would be very complicated for the U.S. government to just shut that down if we're going to cut off relations with Pakistan.
They can't do that. And I also think, you know, what's really at play here is how do you make the relationship more productive? And one thing is honesty, and to be a lot tougher about the fact that it's pretty clear that there are elements within their intelligence agency, the ISI, or elements of their military or their government that must have known his whereabouts. I mean, it's just impossible to imagine. If you look at the geography, if you know that area outside of Islamabad, and you understand what a military canton that is, and you understand just how intimate that is, and that neighbors on the street are talking about having seen this tall man, you know, I mean, it's just impossible. So I think there's a moment here to be sure we handle it right, because we need Pakistan as an ally in this fight against terrorism. But we also need to be tough and honest. And I think it's a time where Petraeus really will come into play here.
General Petraeus,
you know, commander in Afghanistan and most likely soon to be confirmed to be the head of the CIA, has a real extraordinary role to play in this, I think, because he has the clout on the ground to be very tough, and he has the future trajectory of conducting the policies through the CIA that are going to really shape the post 9/11. And I'd say we're in that moment. We're in the post 9/11 phase, 10 years out after the attacks on America. I do think with the death of Osama bin Laden, we've turned a corner in a new direction. And I think we're going to have to be tougher on our allies, more precise in how we fight this long, long struggle against terrorism. And, you know, I'm glad I'm not the policymaker who has to figure out how to do this, but there has to be a way to get a lot more honest with Pakistan.
Well, you mentioned we've turned a corner. No doubt a big page turned this week. Let's move on and talk a little bit about the fallout from the killing of Osama bin Laden. According to the initial review of computer files and documents that were seized from bin Laden's compound, it seems that he played a very direct role in planning terror attacks, that he hadn't become just an inspirational figure that was sort of receding into the background. But in fact, he was plotting attacks, including on U.S. trains and other domestic targets. Peter Canellis, what do you make of this?
Well, I think it shows that we're a lot safer with Osama bin Laden dead and that he was absolutely not an inspirational figure. Look, I think that the fear that keeps everybody up at night in Washington, in Boston, elsewhere, is of some sort of a nuclear attack or other extremely broad scaled terrorist attack in this United States. There aren't that many people who are out there plotting it or who have the international capability of doing something like that. It takes a lot of coordinating, a lot of determination. Osama bin Laden was one who was out there having advertised that ambition, working every minute with every fiber of his being to get that done. We're a lot safer to have that person out of the way, even if what succeeds him is more sporadic attacks, Islamic radicals trying to blow up certain things. That's a terrible problem that has to be dealt with. But I feel like a major threat has been removed with bin Laden's death.
Charlie Sennett.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more, Peter, but I would say, this morning, I just spent a better part of an hour on the phone with Michael Scheuer, who was the former head of the bin Laden unit for the CIA, 23-year veteran of the CIA, really knows bin Laden. And I left with this bone-chilling picture that Zawahiri, the deputy, the Egyptian physician who's now considered the next man in charge, he was bin Laden's deputy, he is operational on a dirty bomb. That's been his push. He wrote a book in 2008 where he laid the theological groundwork for a weapon of mass destruction, or as they call it more precisely, a weapon of mass effect, a dirty bomb. And that he really fears that Zawahiri is operational and that the go trigger for this kind of attack, this level of a new spectacular, as they would call it in the CIA, is bin Laden's death. And that just as you had, you had the death of Massoud on September 9th was the trigger for the September 11th hijackers to go into gear. There was a really chilling conversation this morning with Scheuer where he said he really would theorize, and no one knows, of course, but that a theory would be that the death would somehow now trigger an operational, attempt to carry this out. But, Peter, you're absolutely right. It's difficult. Having bin Laden out of the picture makes us all feel better. But I am worried about the next generation of al-Qaeda and what is its intent, and the idea that right now there's like an hourglass that's just been tipped for them to use the intelligence, this huge trove of intelligence they took out of the compound. It's like you have days, weeks at the most, to figure it out and track down the next high-value targets, Zawahiri at the top of the list.
Well, a chilling scenario indeed. And let's try to bring this a little closer to home. Earlier this week, we talked to Governor Deval Patrick about security in this state. After bin Laden was killed, he convened a meeting with his security team about potential threats facing folks closer to home. Here's what he told us.
There is no new or concerning intelligence, but I think everyone should have heightened awareness and sensitivity to the possibility of retaliation. So that if you've been on the T or at the airport, for example, you will notice more visibility for the time being from our security apparatus and personnel. But as I say, no new information. It's really an excess of caution.
So obviously there's only so much any governor of any state can do about this. But what do you think about the state of homeland security in this state and elsewhere? Peter Canellis.
Well, obviously, we're much more vigilant than we were before September 11th. I think the fact that the attacks were launched from here probably gives Massachusetts an even greater impetus, and has given Massachusetts an even greater impetus to, take take precautions very, very, very seriously. Like the entire rest of the country, though, you know, there are troubling reports that airport security, while vastly improved, is not by any means foolproof. I mean, we had that incident of the unfortunate teenager who stowed away in a plane, apparently got on the tarmac at Charlotte Airport, flying on a plane to Boston, and fell out of the sky because he froze to death. But obviously, if that had been a terrorist, who knows what would have happened with that plane. So, you know, we should feel good that we're in a better place than we were, but are we, you know, is our security foolproof? No.
Charlie, what do you think? I mean, I'm thinking of you in your offices above Boston Harbor there, one of the soft underbellies of this country, perhaps.
Yeah, that's my big fear. You know, talking to local FBI, you know, officials who express, you know, in unguarded moments, a real concern about Boston Harbor, that if there was going to be a dirty bomb, elements of that could be smuggled in a cargo container, or that the container could even be the delivery vehicle for that kind of weapon. Now, at Global Post, you're right. We have our offices right overlooking Boston Harbor, and I see these cargo ships come and go all day, some of them flagged from the Middle East. And you just look at this and you think, you know, your darkest, worst fears, that maybe, you know, as Peter says, the airports for sure are more secure, but it's really what's next. Where are our vulnerable points? And the harbors are one. Another one that's interesting that a lot of CIA officials are talking about right now are the borders, Mexico and Canada, that the idea of how you get a dirty bomb into America is in very small containers over many, many trips and lots of time. And that is another fear they have. And so, I mean, you know, we live in a pretty perilous time, but we've just turned a big corner after September 11th. And as much as I talk to the CIA and FBI sources about all this, I also think it's an important time to remember that we're well into this struggle. We're well into this fight. There are huge successes that have happened along the way. And, they win if we have too much fear and we don't just go on with our lives.
Peter Canellis, before we sort of turn the corner and move on to other thoughts here, I just wanted to get you to talk briefly about Boston this week in relation to this story. Of course, this was the city where two of those planes left. What are your observations about what you observed, felt, thought this week?
I think that there's a great sense of relief, and I think that if anything, people have underestimated the extent to which Bostonians generally, but especially younger Bostonians, really felt the effects of September 11th. I think part of it was that the planes came from here, that we had a number of local victims. We also have a close proximity to New York. But a whole generation really grew up with this shadow over them, and this is really the first positive sign. You know, it's the first step. I mean, we can all say that there wasn't another large-scale attack in the 10 years since 9/11, and that's a big achievement, but there was never a moment to celebrate that achievement. There was never a moment to actually begin to feel safer. And I think that's what was on people's minds as they were celebrating on Boston Common, and also just as they were going about their everyday lives.
Well, let me turn the corner then on that positive note. I want to sort of move on to our hubbubs, those stories that flew under the radar this week. And I want to start with my co-host, Meghna Chakrabarty, and bring her back into the discussion. Meghna, your hubbub.
Well, actually, mine has to do with bin Laden, because President Obama is meeting at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, the members of SEAL Team 6 today, the men who executed, I guess it was called Operation Neptune Spear. Charlie, was that the name of it?
Yeah, I've heard that, and also this code name Geronimo, which is very controversial.
That was, yeah. Well, so my he's going to meet the members of SEAL Team 6, and I'm hoping he meets the dog, apparently, that they had on the team, which, you know, it sparked a lot of reporting about the fact that there are 3,000 or so canine members of the United States military who are highly trained canine soldiers who go out and sniff for bombs, etc. And apparently, even though the military spent some $19 billion investing in technological equipment to be bomb sniffers and
in four-footed investigators, I guess. I don't know. But the technology is only 50% accurate, whereas the dogs are almost 80% accurate.
Truly man's best friend.
Exactly. And apparently this particular member, they won't say what breed it is, of SEAL Team 6, he or she wears a doggy flak jacket, has a infrared camera, and actually an earbud so that it can receive commands remotely.
Remarkable. So. Let's hear it for man's best friend. Peter Canellis, your hubbub.
The state's purchase of 840 acres in western Massachusetts to connect it to the Tallinn State Forest is a great move, and it's a really smart use of the current down real estate market. For $3 million, they got 840 acres of lakes, streams, mountains, hills, a perfectly pristine part of Massachusetts, and it's a great thing, and it may have cost a lot more if they waited a few years.
And for our listeners, you did some your paper did some nice coverage of that today, so thanks for pointing that out. Charlie Sennett. Finally.
Okay, so mine is that in the intensity and much deserved intensity of coverage around Osama bin Laden, World Press Freedom Day went by unrecognized. It's an important day to realize how many reporters out there in the world are risking their lives to try to bring you the story. Americans covering places like Pakistan and Afghanistan, but really reporters all over the world, from Sri Lanka, from Mexico. All of these stories where those local journalists are covering really big stories, we don't think often enough about the perils they all face, including our own correspondent at Global Post, James Foley, who is still detained in Libya. I want to throw a sort of request out to keep thinking about him. We are every day working very hard to bring him home. But also, because it's World Press Freedom Day this week, I would throw a shout out to William Taylor, the former publisher of the Boston Globe. Extraordinary stewardship over the paper, really, and the great hate, this just really made the paper as great as it is. And, on World Press Freedom Day, you need good publishers. And he certainly was one that I think all of us look back. If you know that history, you know just how important he was to this city and how important the Globe was and continues to be to the city.
Well, I'm going to second that hubbub. And speaking of Jim Foley on World Press Freedom Day, we had his mother in earlier this week. And that was an emotional interview for her. But she was making an appeal on his behalf not to forget the likes of Jim Foley, who's still being held, along with a bunch of other journalists, by the way, by Libyan officials. Charlie Sennett, executive editor of Global Post, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And Peter Canellis, Washington bureau chief of the Boston Globe. Always good to have you, Peter.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Up next, your letters and Steven Tyler's latest creation, not an Aerosmith album, but a memoir. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.